Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Fell Into Food podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell, and with me today, Macy Gansler. Macy, thank you for joining. I want to kind of give a quick background and bio of you first, if that's kind of okay with you.
Of course.
All right. So who is Macy Gansler? She currently serves as a strategic advisor for Bon Appetit Management Company. However, prior to becoming an advisor, Macy served as the chief strategy and brand officer and held many other positions within Bon Appetit over the past 25 years. She's also the author of You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime and Other Lessons from the Food Industry and Creating a More Sustainable Company. Now I'm going to do a quick little synopsis of this because we're going to jump into that title here in a second. So many businesses are in the dark about how to actually do better for the planet and the people in their company and their supply chain while also growing their margin. Some believe it can't be done, but it can. Macy has done it, and now she's going to show you how to build sustainability into your business. Her five big lessons come from three decades of success and failures, leading a $1.7 billion corporation toward a more sustainable future. In the book, she takes you to a pig farm, boardrooms, factories, farmers markets, teaching you not only how to operate more sustainably, but also how to get the credit you deserve for doing it. And what really caught my attention as I started reading the book was the first line. I'm just going to read the first line. You spray shit in the air. People can't breathe. And apologies on the name if I get it wrong, but Fidel Baccio?
Yeah, Fidel Baccio, exactly.
CEO of Bon Appetit Management Company, and my boss is fired up. So I guess, you know, we're going to jump into the book first, but really, where did your passion for sustainability come from? And what does that word sustainability mean to you?
Well, I grew up with two parents who were in social services, and I rebelled and said, I am going into business. I am not going to be just making a small amount of money to be a do-gooder. I am going to go into business. But it turns out that the proverbial apple doesn't fall that far from the tree. And when I saw that business could be used to make change in your community, to support people who are doing things in a more environmentally friendly way, to care for animals, I was hooked. And sustainability became a true passion, as well as a way to further our brand at Bon Appetit.
Yeah. So your book title, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. Really intriguing, right? Can you elaborate on the connection between branding and sustainability?
Well, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime refers to the story that you started to tell about Fidel being really fired up about shit or manure being sprayed in the air. He had spent 2 years on something called the Pew Commission for Industrial Farm Animal Production, learning how food was being made in this country at large scale. And one of the things that really offended him was the use of manure lagoons in pig farming. And it's just what it sounds like. It's thousands of pigs in one place all pooping and that being captured in a lake or a lagoon. And then to get rid of that waste, one of the ways that it's done is it's sprayed on nearby fields. And the communities surrounding these industrial pig operations have higher incidences of asthma, lung disease, all sorts of trouble. And Fidel was pissed about it. So he set about trying to make change, which included meeting with the country's largest pig supplier, who happened to also be our pork supplier. And I sat in this conference room listening to Fidel yell at this guy about the manure lagoons. And I thought, this is awesome. I work for an incredible company, for an incredible leader. We're going to make change about something that's really important. We're going to move towards a more sustainable food system. But then I also thought, how am I going to market this? How are we going to get credit with customers for it? How do you talk about manure at lunchtime? It's really unappetizing. And that's really what the book is about. It's this dual connection between using sustainability as both a lever for change, but also for market credit. And so to answer your question, I see them as being intertwined in for-profit business.
Great. Yeah, I think you have a copy there. Throw that up on the screen. I'd love to show it so that way people, there you go. And we'll put this in link in the show notes as well. But I absolutely love the title and that. In your book, you talk about challenges of implementing sustainable practices in the food industry. What do you see as being one of the biggest obstacles, and how can businesses overcome that?
Well, I think the biggest obstacle is first the idea that sustainability costs more money. And yes, in many cases, you're talking about more expensive ingredients. However, I also think that that's a narrow-minded view of how to get to a profitable business, especially in the restaurant industry. We all know we want people to come to our restaurants more often, and we want a higher average check, right? Frequency and average check is what's going to drive your profitability, really. And so looking at sustainability only as an expense really is too myopic. You have to look at sustainability as a revenue driver, as a way to get people to come more often and to eat more. That would be the first kind of misconception or barrier. And the second, I think, is an oversimplification from customers and from advocacy groups that it really is just about money, that if a company or a restaurant would simply pay more, they could be more sustainable. When in fact, the real challenge is often the complexity of a supply chain and all of the moving parts of a restaurant operation and trying to weave better ingredients throughout it.
Yeah, I noticed that in my operations that, you know, I was fortunate when I was in a university, it was a very sustainable university, and we put a lot of measures in place. And even with all those sustainable measures that we put in place, we actually were driving food costs down by being more efficient operators, purchasing properly, producing less waste in food, using our production records to properly forecast and have the proper cycle put together. And by doing that, we again were able to increase our sustainability. I remember scraping out cans, rinsing them. We did everything you could think of. And that kind of carried through my whole career. So when I hear this and like seeing your book, I was like, spot on. You can be sustainable and practical. And actually, you can drive costs down if you're smart about it in other areas. To your point, everyone just thinks it's a straight cost. Oh, I have to go to a compostable plastic or a compostable servingware or something like that. But that's not always the case. And there are a lot of hidden ways that I think folks can do it. So maybe explain kind of your time at Bon Appetit then, like how, what were some of those ways or structures that you did to help kind of reduce costs while kind of pushing that sustainability movement?
Well, first of all, I saw more sustainable ingredients as a cost neutral as being the goal, not cost savings. And so what that means is if we were able to save money in some areas, like for example, sustainable seafood, by definition, seafood that's more sustainable is more plentiful. There is more of it available, and therefore it can be less expensive. Now, that's different than if you're trying to get something that is the last fish in the sea, right? Something that's really rare. But if you're going for something that is a plentiful fish, like if you're moving from a Atlantic cod to a Pacific cod to a pollock, you're still getting a flaky white fish, but you're going down in cost. And when I would save a little money on something like that, I would spend it on another ingredient. So trying to stay at cost neutrality, like almost my own cap and trade system, versus just cherry picking the things that save money. Mm-hmm. And then something that's really important in that story that you told about your own experience is having discipline in the kitchen and having systems in place. And so sustainability is not just about a desire or an intention, but how do you really operate the most efficiently? How do you use the whole animal? How do you use the whole vegetable, right? From stem to root, the entire thing. How do you waste less? Can you use peels? Things like that. I think food waste reduction is a really easy entry point into sustainability because nobody is pro food waste, and it is cost savings. I think we have to always be aware, though, of the labor implications. Sometimes things that are faster are being done to save labor? And so how do we balance both?
Yeah, it definitely is a juggling trick of, you know, everyone, you know, you sacrifice on one side to gain on the other and vice versa. And it's this fine balance. Do you have a highlight of one or two of some of the, you know, you said the COD, but other successful sustainable practices that you encountered or that you implemented?
One that was really cool was when we moved to a ground beef that was raised without antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we found that we could actually shrink the burgers because this beef that was raised without antibiotics didn't lose as much water in cooking. So you would start out with a 5-ounce burger of conventional meat, and it would wind up after you cooked it the same size as what you'd start with a 4-ounce burger of the meat raised with antibiotics. So you could cut an ounce of meat just right out the top. That was a great win.
That's crazy. I know I did before you go to the next one. I did the same kind of study. I did like an eye round versus a top round, and between labor and the loss of muscle because of the animal of fabricating and cooking, I ended up finding out that eye round actually was a better choice because you would get better yields out of that product and have cost savings at the same time by utilizing different cooking techniques, you know, to break something down that traditionally you wouldn't potentially use. So what do you have another example or any other successful practices you put into play?
Well, another thing that's a great technique is to use a more luxury ingredient, but use it in a much smaller way. And you get kind of a double bang for your buck. So if you're trying to move to a more plant forward menu, for example, still use a little bit of a meat or cheese, but use one that's got a real cachet to the name. So people are excited to have just an ounce of it sprinkled across the top, and that wows them, but you're not putting 5 ounces of animal protein onto your salad or onto your plate. We really tried a lot to rebalance the plate to putting vegetables forward and really taking care in cooking them. Nobody wants to eat steamed broccoli, right? Plain. I mean, maybe you do, but not really. But as soon as you start talking about roasting it and adding a little olive oil and Calabrian chili on it, now it becomes something that we desire, something that's delicious, and it can take up a larger proportion of the plate, and customers will actually be happy eating more broccoli and less beef.
Oh, yeah, I love that. I do Brussels sprouts with a roasted Brussels sprout with a sweet chili sauce. Changes the whole complexity. Everyone has always just Brussels sprouts. It's got to be bacon, you know, and bacon fat. But there's a couple ways I've been doing it and playing with Brussels. And it's an experience I think people need to be a little more open-minded to and trying, because when you start adding some other flavors, some of the things that you would think that you're typical. And I think that goes back to how people were raised or grew up, is traditional, just bland, steamed, boiled type vegetables. And it just kind of off-put them, where there's so many more techniques that we can do in the kitchen.
One cool one that some of our chefs figured out was when cooking with tofu, to actually break the tofu up with your hands, as opposed to it being in cubes. It has a different mouthfeel. And if you're going to do something like making a buffalo tofu, for example, it breads differently. It holds the coating in a different way. Same with a sauce. You get some nooks and crannies in there. It's going to hold a sauce, and it's less clinical as squares of tofu.
That is so funny that you say that. I had Alicia Bell from the Humane Society on a prior episode, and she said the exact same thing talking about tofu. And you just reiterate that. To pull it apart versus the traditional just cutting or cubing it. So it's great to hear that from multiple folks that, you know, tofu's not dead. You got to know what to do with it. Now with your experience, you know, in cross disciplinary management, right? You got different departments, you've got culinary, purchasing, marketing, you know, how do all those departments work cohesively towards that common goal?
Well, my title at Bon Appetit was Chief Strategy and Brand Officer. And as you say, underneath that, I had culinary, marketing, communications, purchasing, wellness, and guest-facing technology. And on the face of it, that seems like a weird cross-section of departments to have, especially something like purchasing, which would usually sit in finance. But we at Bon Appetit recognized that those all touch the brand because they touch the product, the food. I mean, what is more important to your brand as a restaurant company than the ingredients you buy? I interviewed 12 people for the book, and one of them was a chef, David Kinch, and he says something to the effect of, you can't make good food from bad ingredients. It breaks the laws of physics, right? So you start your brand with the best tasting ingredients possible. And then what you didn't hear me say in any of those departments or in my title was the word sustainability. I strongly believe that if you put that in somebody's title, it becomes their job and not everybody's job. Mm-hmm. And it has to be part of the purchasing department's job. It has to be part of the wellness team's job. It has to be part of the communications team's job. You have to be weaving sustainability into everything you're doing. And it's simple things that might even go unrecognized, like when we would put together examples of dishes in our culinary rollout guides internally, we never would use a beef example. Now, we didn't say you can't use beef, but we would always put forward a plant-forward example as the sample, and then have chefs iterate from there. When putting out a sample catering guide out of our graphics department, it would, again, not be heavy on beef or other red meats. It would be more focused on being vegetable forward, just to say subconsciously, here's what the model menu looks like.
Yeah, the power of subconscious has quite a bit of effect on folks, more than you know. Now, beyond food, you know, what lessons from your experience at Bon Appetit, you know, can be applied to businesses looking to scale and integrate sustainability? Because usually at a small scale, it's somewhat easier. It can be easier. And then as you tend to scale, it seems that those initiatives take a backseat almost sometimes. So how would, you know, as a company is growing, how do they scale that and integrate more?
Well, one of the things that we did at Bon Appetit in relation to scale is that we ran essentially two supply chains. So we had our farm to fork suppliers, which was over 1,400 small farmers and artisans. And that is where you think of the traditional work of more sustainable sourcing as happening. And it's the more romantic. It's the, you get to go out to a farm and see the animals and taste farm fresh produce that's ripened on the vine. And that's all really important. And it can be done at scale in the sense of, again, we had over 1,400 of these that we worked with across the country. However, we also ran a more conventional supply chain, because when you're at scale, you're going to wind up buying a lot of stuff from the broadliners, the Sysco, the U.S. Food Service of the world, the big meat companies, the Tysons, the Purdue's, the Smithfields, et cetera. At Bon Appetit, we did over 250 million meals a year. So hard to do using completely small local vendors, right? But working with those big vendors, those people that are really working at a large scale, I think is where some of the most important work in sustainability is done. Because if you're a large customer and you get a seat at the table, you can start asking questions about antibiotics use. You can ask questions about animal welfare, like gestation crates or tail docking. You can ask questions about how much nitrogen fertilizer is applied to a field, about how crop rotation is done. So at scale, you have different issues, but you also have more power.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, how do you think consumer awareness and their attitudes towards sustainability in food have evolved over the years? And are you seeing kind of a significant change in their behavior?
When we started talking about sustainability externally, we had already had our farm to fork commitment, our commitment to local suppliers. We had already been working on antibiotics. We were already committed to sustainable seafood, but we weren't talking about that to customers at all. We didn't think customers would care. So it was really 2004 that we started talking externally about these issues. And we kicked it off with a national roadshow, going to all the regions across the country and talking to chefs and managers about this this change we were making to kind of our go-to-market strategy. And at that point, so really 20 years ago, the chefs were really excited because of the flavor implications about how great these ingredients were. But they didn't think customers were going to care. And in fact, many of our senior leaders said, maybe college students will care, but corporate employees will never care. Nobody really is interested in this stuff. Fast forward, every single request for proposal that we got for food service had a sustainability section in it. Every single college, every corporation, every museum, every stadium now wants to have more sustainable food options because their constituents, be it their employees or their customers, absolutely demand this. I also think that some of the stuff that used to stand out, like farm to table, is now just table stakes. I think customers really expect that at the majority of non-chain restaurants, I'll say, that you're buying from your local suppliers. So if you want to differentiate yourself and really wow customers, I think that things have gotten harder in many ways.
Yeah. You know, as we continue to look in the future, you know, with the rise of alternative proteins, you know, are they really more sustainable and better for the environment? Or should we still be kind of going back to the conventional of truly a more true plant-based eating?
Well, I think that what's really important to start with is how do you define sustainable and how do you define better for the environment? If you look at something like Impossible, Pat Brown, the founder of Impossible, had one focus, climate change. And he decided that reducing the number of cows was the fastest way to stemming climate change. Well, climate change is one view towards sustainability, but it's not the only view, right? You might think about sustainability also encompassing soil health. You might think about sustainability being economic sustainability of a community. You might think of many other dimensions of sustainability than climate change, which isn't to say he's wrong, just to say that he has one very specific focus. So when you talk about alt proteins, more sustainable than what, right? So Impossible or Beyond is definitely less climate intensive than a conventionally raised cow. Absolutely. They've got the science to show that. Is it less climate intensive than eating a carrot? Well, no, it isn't. But they would argue nobody was going to trade carrots for burgers, you know? And so I think it's about where you start and about the lens that you're looking through.
Now, do you think more farms, because it's something I've been exposed to more of regenerative farming, in which it's more of a full ecosystem. So you could keep the beef, keep the cows, but the way that you're planting the crops, planting clover to pull that some of that methane and that nitrogen and pull it back into the ground, then be able to plant, you know, something like a corn that is very nitrogen intense. So that way it's full circle to offset its own. Do you think that's going to become more and more of a play to help with the sustainability?
Yes and no. Yes, in that regenerative is getting a lot of buzz these days. And no, in that I think the term is being co-opted because there isn't a strict definition of it. So there are a few movements. There's a group called Regen One that's working on a definition and almost a certification with a website to get information. I think if people really do it, and we have a way to verify more regenerative practices, it absolutely can be part of the solution. I think if it's watered down and just becomes another label like natural, then no.
I love that answer. Again, kind of almost like a SMART goal. It's got to be measurable and obtainable, and it has to be something on paper that all can apply by the same rules or saying, well, this is what we do. And we call it regenerative. And then
totally.
Like, that gimmick of, is it really though? Is it? next thing I've got, you know, what are some exciting trends you see shaping the future of food as a whole?
Well, I think what really excites me is the globalization in terms of how many different flavors we're pulling from around the world and the trend towards being more authentic and recognizing the people who are the originators, you know, the whole cultural appreciation versus appropriation. But I'm really enjoying appreciating a lot of different flavors. And so many of them are naturally more sustainable. There are so many cultures where they couldn't afford meat or they weren't raising meat, where they were really vegetable forward or just using meat as a garnish. And so I think we'll see that continue. Another trend that I think is exciting is reevaluating what wellness and what healthy looks like. And that it not just being about low calorie or low fat, but really about whole ingredients, about something like satiety being part of the wellness conversation, that you don't have to be hungry or punish yourself in order to be healthy or healthful, and having many a much broader view of those terms. I think that's exciting. And then, yes, there's the science of food, right? There's the alt proteins, as you talked about, the cultivated meats and fish that are coming. And I think it's interesting. I don't think it's the panacea. I'm not sure that we're going to use technology to get us out of this whole climate change mess. We're going to have to eat some carrots too. But it's interesting and intriguing, I would say.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, if there were any under the radar technologies that could help. Like you said, it's not going to replace, but anything that's been coming out to support. I know, feel like for an example, I had Diana from RTI. They're an oil management company in which they reduce plastics and oil and fuel in the environment. But any technologies you think that can impact on top of also changing your eating habits?
I've talked to a couple startups that are using food waste to create plastic, and I think that's a really exciting idea. That if we could, they are using a centrifuge and then creating a sludge that they ferment. Two companies doing it in a slightly different way, but winding up with a plastic substance that, for example, even if a fish ate, if it got into the ocean, would be fish feed because it's fundamentally food that's being converted, and using food waste as opposed to PLA, for example, that uses a monocropped GMO corn. So kind of killing two birds with one stone, food waste and also plastics. That's exciting. I sit on the board of a company called Air Protein, which is making protein from the molecules of air. So using hydrogen and fermenting it to create a protein. And what's really exciting about that to me is that you can create protein anywhere. So many of the alt meat companies are using soy or pea protein, which still takes arable land, less intensive than cows, but still using land and water. And so the idea that we could take hydrogen and you could produce protein in tanks in a arid part of Africa or anywhere really. I think that's really cool.
That is fascinating. I want to just double click on the byproduct being plastics. What kind of timeline or horizon would you see, or if you know where those companies are, or when potentially you could see not mass adoption, but early stage where someone might hop on and be giving that a try?
They're both in the pilot stages, so they've got actual operations making pilot level amounts of their sludge. That's probably not the word they want me to use. And then trying to see how they can convert that into plastics. So my guess is that we are years away from real commercial adoption, but years as in a few, you know, 3 to 5, not 20 to 50.
Yeah, I could probably talk all day on these. Those two topics fascinate me. Just the science and technology behind that, especially even hydrogen is, you know, that you're seeing that adopted in the automotive, or that's what's the next push is the hydrogen. It's abundant, it's plentiful. There's almost unlimited amounts of it. Let's see, where do I want to go? You know, what advice would you give to aspiring entrepreneurs or business owners, you know, that want to build sustainability into the core of their ventures? You know, that's kind of the buzz. You know, you have like Expo West, where everyone wants to have that at their, you know, into their product in some way, or at least the words. But how do they really integrate that into the core of what they do?
Well, first, to really define which piece of sustainability you're going to take on. It's such a broad term, and it means almost nothing. It's been so overused. And so which piece? Is it climate change? Is it regenerative agriculture? Is it water use? Which piece of sustainability are you going to own and make sure that you are expert on that and that everybody within your organization is expert on that? You probably can't do everything. So which pieces are you going to take on? And then take a look at all of the systems throughout your organization and make sure that they are in support of that goal. And what I mean by that is everything like your compensation strategy. Are people incented just to reduce costs, or are they also incented to whatever measurement you're using of your sustainability strategy? Are they actually, is that part of their pay? If people aren't getting paid for it, they're probably not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Your communication strategy. If you've got a corporate newsletter, are you talking about these issues in your corporate newsletter, or are you highlighting people who had the best sales record? You know, of course you want that sales record piece also, but you also want to talk about the person, the chef that partnered with a new farmer to bring on a new ingredient that maybe was a bumper crop, and the farmer had a lot of, and the chef quickly integrated that into their menu, something like that, so that people are getting lots of reinforcement every day from every direction that this is what the company values.
And what sort of tools are out there? Is there a way for, you know, these startup to kind of dig into, you know, I want this to be part of it. I maybe don't have as much background or knowledge. Is there somewhere they can go, something they can read, something they can do to help jumpstart that?
Well, of course, I would love them to read my book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. I would also point people towards, there's a great online publication called Civil Eats that deals with that there's first person reporting on many issues related to sustainability in the food system. And I think that's a great entree into what the hot issues are and where the complexities are. And then you can start learning more based on what you discover on a site like Civil Eats. Barry Estabrook has written a couple really great books, Tomato Land and Pigtails, talking about farm workers issues and pork production. Pick your entree in, and there will be plenty of information.
Great. I'll put those into the show notes too. I'll put links so that way folks can easily access that. You know, for individuals that want to make more sustainable choices in their lives, where do you suggest they start?
Well, I suggest that you start in eating a more plant-forward menu. Diet. And I'm not saying to go vegan at all. Take a look at where you are. Are you eating meat 5 nights a week? Can you go down to 3? Or do you always serve a 6 or 8 ounce portion of meat? Can you go down to a 2 or 3 ounce portion? And then as you're eating less of it, can you maybe start looking at buying something that has been raised in a more responsible way because you're buying a smaller portion of it or buying it less frequently? The other thing would be, as we've been talking about, to start experimenting with cooking vegetables in more interesting ways, using some of the techniques that we've thought of for meat, like braising and slow roasting and applying them to vegetables. Now, I've been talking a lot, you know, you asked a question that could have been a real scientific response, and I'm talking about eating because I think that it's got to be pleasurable. If we start trying to think about sustainability as a task that we have to accomplish, that means denying ourselves something that we want or using a product that doesn't function as well as we'd like it to, like some of the more sustainable containers are. I think that's a losing proposition. So start with things that you can really derive pleasure from and go from there.
Absolutely love it. Try new things. That's the easiest way, is to try something. And if you don't know, there's tons of cookbooks. Now with the internet and YouTube, you can watch someone make almost anything. I know there's been the sensations of carrot bacon to all sorts of stuff with mushrooms. So give some of those a try. I have just a couple fun in the weeds questions for you. So the first one, what's your go-to comfort food?
I like anything that involves an Asian noodle. So I like a pho, I like a ramen, Anything that's soupy with a noodle in it, I am there for.
Oh, man, it's so good. If you find a good pho place, it's hard to beat, getting a nice warm bowl of broth with those noodles. Sweet or savory?
Sweet, I think. I hate to say it, but I get teased all the time for my sweet tooth, and I really do love a good old child ice cream.
Ice cream.
Sweet, yeah.
Just talking the top of ice cream, and we're talking plant-based, and I think I brought it up in the last episode. But I don't know if you're on the West Coast, correct? Out in
Yes.
California. You've got a, have you heard of Eclipse Ice Cream?
No.
Oh, you've got to give it a try. They're big in non-com, and I think they're slowly getting into retail. I think they're on the West Coast, but a plant-based, truly plant-based. It's not, almond or coconut. It's a plant-based, phenomenal product. So if you ever get a chance or you see it,
Eclipse.
Eclipse, yeah, just like solar eclipse. It's really good stuff. I know a lot of their folks over there. They do great work and provide a high quality product. So give that a try if you got a sweet tooth for ice cream.
I will. One of the things I like stuff in my ice cream, like caramel or chocolate or like chunks of things. And I feel like a lot of the plant-based ice creams could do themselves a favor by not being just smooth ice cream, but putting some stuff in it.
So
Ben
they
and
do.
Jerry's has done. Okay, Eclipse has done that.
Yeah, they have a caramel praline. I think it's praline. Phenomenal. Or caramel cashew. It's something with it is. That's my favorite out of all of them. Absolutely love it. And to your point, yeah, it's more than just a vanilla or chocolate. They've got a few flavors that have something. I think there's a brownie bite one now. Oh man, got little brownie chunks. So they don't shy away completely to putting, some good quality stuff. You can make a good vegan brownie these days. Last one, dine in or dine out?
Dine in. I am not part of the Uber Eats generation. I've never caviared anything or DoorDashed or I'm gonna go sit in that restaurant and enjoy the total experience.
I agree. I absolutely love the experience. Maisie, anything else you want to tell the audience? Or I'd like you to make sure you plug, where to find you, your book, etc.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. You can find me on my website, maisiegansler.com. It's a lot of letters, but I bet Jeff will put it in the show notes so people can find it. I used to be the number one search result on Maisie until that dang Game of Thrones and Maisie Williams, whoever she is. But she is more popular than I am now. The book is available at many local independent booksellers, but also, of course, at Amazon.
Awesome.
And I hope overall that my message in the book and in this conversation that we've had here today is that you can do things in a more sustainable way, and it doesn't have to be painful, but it does take real work and strategy. And the book is really meant to be a how-to guide with lots of action steps to keep you fo moving forward on your path towards more sustainability.
Wow, I love it. Maisie, thank you so much for being on. Go pick up her book. You can't market manure at lunchtime. I know I started reading it, especially after I read line one. And I know on Amazon, you can even get a preview of the intro in chapter one. So you can get a little glimpse of it before you jump in and buy it, but I highly recommend it. So again, thank you, Maisie, for being on. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.
Thank you.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.